afternoon. So the talk this afternoon is entitled Effort, Hindrances, and Awakening Factors. And I assure you the talk will be more exciting than the title. So one thing about Vallecitos, about the teachings here, and those of you, many of you have been here many times, so you probably know, one of the benefits of teaching at a retreat center such as this one is that most of the teachings you get on the various retreats here, most of the teachers are coming from a similar perspective. So largely that perspective is insight meditation, as it's known, which has been going on for maybe 40, 50 years in our culture. Insight meditation, mindfulness as we know it now, and really drawing its theory and practice. And a lot of the ideas and the things that we learn about on these retreats come from the Theravada Buddhist school thinking, and in particularly probably largely the Pali Canon, which is understood as the oldest teachings, the teachings that might might be accurate and might be close to what this historic person might have taught. So you, with that, you'll find, and you've probably gathered, and maybe even so far we haven't mentioned a lot, but we have lists in Dharma practice. And sometimes some people like lists. I'm a person, for some bizarre reason, I like lists of terms. But sometimes it can be kind of confusing or odd. Of like, is this just a practice of worshiping lists? Is that what we're doing here? So I'm going to try to talk about that in a way so that it's maybe these lists are helpful. And just talking about where do they come from. And so when you are trying to translate an ancient language such as Pali, which is a language nobody speaks anymore and nobody's spoken in quite some time, is that when the translators go through these texts, what happens is ever so often they'll find a series of terms that repeat. So they might notice, well, these four or five terms just keep repeating a lot, so they must be important. So let's circle them, let's extract them, and make a list. Right? So we have all of these lists that kind of get extracted from that. And they're not necessarily lists for memorizations. They're actually really teaching tools. They're teaching devices. They're really probably more of a formula of how to really kind of work with experience. And so lists is a good mnemonic device, and it's a good way to remember things. And so a lot of the teachings that you hear, if you've listened to Dharma talks, you've probably heard many people give many talks on lists. So I'm going to try to, we have these lists of efforts, these lists of hindrances, and these lists of awakening factors. I'm going to try to bring this into a context that's actually helpful and really trying to get down to what is it that we are trying to develop. Because we use words like cultivate a lot. Well, cultivate what? And trying to see how can we use these things as really instructions or teaching tools so we can really kind of discern moment to moment, what is it that we are up to? Because I can't tell you how many times I've been on a retreat thinking to myself, what was I supposed to be doing again? The breath? Was it the breath or something, kindness? Or pay attention to the sounds? It's like it gets, you might have noticed sometimes you forget, what was I supposed to be doing again? And so I mentioned this the other night, but the thing that I like is the most basic definition of the path that goes all the way back to the Sutta Nipata, which is the oldest strata, is really nicely, succinctly put, and that is to abandon what is unskillful and to cultivate what is skillful, or to abandon what is unwholesome and to cultivate what is wholesome. That's the most basic definition of the path. Right? So if that's the path, we're trying to do this on a moment-to-moment level, and then so the question becomes, well, what is skillful and what is unskillful? And so this word skillful, I think, is a really good term because it gets us a little bit out of good and bad and right and wrong. Skillful is a term that the Buddha pulled from artisans. He uses lots of analogies of woodworkers and farmers and artists and potters. In one definition, early definitions, he says, just as a carpenter skillfully shapes a piece of wood, and just like a fletcher fashions an arrow, or just like a farmer prepares the soil, so the practitioner, the meditator, shapes the mind. And so that really what we're trying to do is we're trying to shape and we're trying to incline this mind towards what is skillful, what is wholesome, what is constructive, what is beautiful, what is useful. Right? Because ultimately where we live in our minds. I like to think that I live in the world. I live in Peonia, Colorado. But really, I live in my mind. And everything that I experience gets filtered through my mind. So it's probably a good idea for me to really take that seriously and go, well, probably the first thing I really ought to do is get this mind working for me rather than against me. And if I can get my mind working for me and I can incline my mind in a direction, then everything else will follow, is a theory. And I think it's a pretty easy to acknowledge theory. So we're really trying to really cultivate this mind. And just like the carpenter or the potter or the farmer, mostly what the carpenter has done in his quest, in his endeavor of shaping the wood properly, he's probably spent a lot of time shaping the wood inaccurately. Probably made lots of mistakes. Right? So there's that kind of combination that when we're trying to be skilled at something, as we're learning a new skill, mostly what we do is we fail. Right? It takes a long time to develop skills and takes like practice, which is a word actually that I don't know the Pali correlation, but there's a word in the early discourses that means to practice. To just really, and it's sometimes it's so easy to forget that really we're just practicing. And usually if we practice piano or soccer or anything that we practice, we usually don't get caught up in, am I doing this right? Like when somebody's practicing the piano, they might be frustrated and fumbling with the keys, but they're probably not thinking, am I practicing right? Or if you're exercising or lifting weights, you're probably not asking yourself, am I doing this right? But for some reason, I don't know what it is, if I would ever find out the data, if anybody ever figures that out, I'd be happy. For some reason, when we come in these retreats and we try to cultivate the mind and practice mindfulness, there seems to be this often occurring theme of, I don't know if I'm doing this right. And so that's just kind of a wrong attitude, right? An unskillful attitude, because it's not really the point. Right? You are all doing the retreat, whether you realize it or not. This is it. This is what you're doing. You can't do it wrong, actually. Wrong would be driving down the driveway, which is what yet I've yet to see anybody do yet. Right. And so when we speak of, if we're doing a skill, we're developing a skill, there's work involved clearly, and that work we could call effort. So there's an elbow grease to this. Anything that you've ever done in your life, any accomplishment that you've ever overcome, anything that you've ever achieved required effort. Right? Everything you've done, whether you went to school and got a degree, you know, whether you've been skilled in different jobs, in different works, it all takes effort. Right? And so that's really kind of the basic energy quality that the mind needs to kind of engage in. And there's lots of different terms for effort. I'll just kind of say what some of those are. So the base basic one is padana, which means effort, but really what it means is endeavor. So we could say that there's an endeavor that we're undertaking here. And the endeavor, again, is to try to cultivate and develop these skillful states of mind and to abandon or to overcome what's unskillful. That's the kind of general endeavor, or we would even maybe say the application. That's one of the words that we see. The other word that we see is vamaya, which is samavamaya, which is the right effort of the Eightfold Path, which again means effort, but really kind of means more like application. Because effort is one of these things. I can put lots of effort into all kinds of fruitless endeavors, and I have, and I'm sure you have too. So there has to be a sense of what is the application for this effort. The other word I think that's kind of a word that's lost its meaning and importance in our culture and society is this word virya, which is usually translated as energy, but can be really translated as courage. Cheryl mentioned that the other day, and I like this word. Whatever happened to courage? I think we always think of courage as things like the Roman and the Greek gods, mythology. Courage is something people used to have a long time ago. We've given up on courage, seems like. In one section of the word virya in the canon is stated as the state of a hero. So it's considered to be heroic to try to endeavor or try to engage in this practice. And really, to take your mind on as a project is a very heroic task. One in which most people clearly are not interested in. Right? As they say, the mind is a wonderful servant, but a horrible master. Right? So when we take our mind out of the project, which is largely what we do, and I think on this retreat for sure, I mean, the pile of clay that you're working with is right here. And let me tell you, it's a difficult pile of clay to try to shape it and to try to mold it and to try to get it to do what you would like it to do or not to do what you want it to stop doing. So effort's not necessarily a great word because sometimes that can imply exertion or striving or trying too hard. All right, so the effort needs to be kind of relaxed or probably more likely balanced. So what's a balanced effort? And then when we look at the foundations of mindfulness, they're structured in a way that one of the foundations that I used to not teach for a long time because I wasn't really quite sure how it worked is the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is usually categorized as mindfulness of dhammas. And I was like, well, what the hell does that even mean? You get these other set of these five lists again. You're like, oh, great, here we go with the list. But when you look, there's a guy named Bhikkhu Anayo who's done lots of writing on Satipatthana. And one of the things that he's done is he has taken all the different versions of the Satipatthana, the ones found in the Pali Canon, the ones found in the Chinese Agamas, the Tibetan version. He's taken all the different versions of the Satipatthana and has cross-referenced them and done all this academic work that none of us have to do, thank God. And he boiled it down to say, okay, what is really happening in these Satipatthanas? And I just want to read this thing because I found it was funny when I finally found what he said the task of the fourth foundation was. So I'm like, okay, this guy did all this work. And the final analysis is he calls the summary. And there's two sentences. He boiled it down to two sentences. He says, the task of the fourth Satipatthana, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, is to monitor the mind on the path to liberation. So what does that mean? So really what we're doing moment to moment here with some degree of success is we are monitoring. I think that's a lot of what mindfulness is about, monitoring the mind's inclinations, its tendencies, its behaviors. There's a kind of watchfulness, right? We're not just watching the sounds and the sights, but we are watching the movement of the mind, which you can do, which is kind of profound that you can do that, I think. I think it's really quickly that many of us, I know that I do this, I underestimate the value of the ability that I have to actually watch my mind. And not to be identified to it, but not like be a dog chasing his tail, which is what I was like most of my life, but be able to say like, well, I can like kind of babysit and keep an eye on this thing. So part of it is monitoring the progress. And he says, the two essential components of this path are overcoming the hindrances and cultivating the awakening factors. So if we wanted to, we could almost assess that moment to moment. We could monitor, is the mind being corrupted, being swept away, being pulled into hindrances, or is the mind waking up? We almost could even say, am I falling asleep or am I waking up? Now, if we were to take a moment, if we were to take 1 minute of practice on this retreat and kind of dissect it and look at it through a magnifying glass, we'd probably notice there was waking up and falling asleep and waking up and falling asleep. And it was probably on a moment-to-moment level, we kind of dip back and forth, don't we? Right? And again, we don't want to fall into the assumption that being awake is good and I'm doing it right and falling asleep is bad and wrong. And when I'm doing that, I'm not doing the retreat correctly. But what it is, there's a meta-awareness we're being asked to be able to just kind of watch that entire process, right? And the hindrances, I think, is of the word, it also would fit well in the second noble truth. Craving, clinging, the hindrances are kind of shorthand for that. Wanting, not wanting, craving, clinging, the hindrances have that quality. But I like the word hinder, because usually in the second noble truth, we get this, I think, troubling idea that there's a cause of suffering, right? And so like that gets kind of annoying after a while. This harping around on dukkha and suffering is why Buddhism gets its pessimistic, I think, undeserved reputation. But it's not saying that these hindrances are causing anything, but they're hindering. What are they hindering me from? They're obstructing something. They're actually blocking the path. So it's not so much that these hindrances cause suffering, which certainly they do, but actually what's more importantly is that they're blocking you from something. Craving and clinging, hindrances, these things. I think sometimes they get too held in a derogatory tone of like, oh, these things are causing suffering and they're so terrible and so bad. But let's be honest, sometimes we're caught up in the hindrances and we're totally enjoying it. Like craving is actually quite pleasant much of the time. So I'd be like, I'm not causing suffering. I'm having a great time thinking about what I'm going to go on vacation next summer. Like these Dharma teachers got to rethink this stuff because I am not suffering at all right now. I'm having a fabulous time. Right? You've probably done some of this today. And then you have to negotiate that. Like, well, did I come here to think about stuff or cultivate awareness? And so it's not, again, it's not that it's causing something. It's not that it's bad, that it's wrong. It's that it's not the direction of the path. And to some degree, it's an obstruction. You're getting blocked. It doesn't go anywhere. Let's be honest. Thinking doesn't mostly really go anywhere. It just goes round and round, which is another word I think that's just poorly described in the Dharma world as samsara. Samsara just means to go round and round. You ever feel like you're just in your mind going round and round and round on the same topic for 20 years? Yeah, that's what happens. So it's a hindrance. The term is nivarana. And what it does is specifically is it hinders progress of the path. That's what it does. So I think if you look at it that way, if it's obstructing me from something that I actually want, I feel a little bit more inclined to tackle it rather than having under this derogatory tone of, oh, this is causing suffering and I shouldn't be doing this. Because again, it's difficult to navigate moment to moment because a lot of times we're enjoying it. We enjoy the movies of the mind. Sometimes. Depends on which one you clicked on. Sometimes we watch horrible movies in the mind for some reason. I don't know. I'm like, why am I even watching this again? I know how it ends. Right? And so again, I'm not waking up. I'm not progressing. I'm not making progress. I'm not cultivating. I'm not being skillful, actually. Right? So we want to develop these kinds of skills. The awakening factors are this interesting term called the bojangas, which is a fun word to say, bojanga. But the bojanga, the first part, it comes from the word bodhi, which means to be awake. And then the last part is really a faculty or a factor or something that helps, something that contributes, something that is to be brought into being. So we want to develop, but really the word is bhavana. We want to cultivate these qualities of mind. And so I'll kind of ping-pong between the awakening factors and the hindrances. And so if we look at the efforts, there's four of them, and it gives us a perfectly great, to me, I think it's the most useful list, actually, because it gives me a very clear assignment, and I like a clear assignment. It says we want to prevent these unskillful states of mind from arising, right? We want to overcome them when they have arisen. So when the hindrances are in my mind, when craving is in my mind, when aversion is in my mind, restlessness, I want to overcome that. Well, how do you do that? Well, we can talk about that, and you've been trying to do it for the last couple of days, you've probably noticed. We want to prevent and overcome these unskillful aspects, and we want to cultivate or develop and maintain these wholesome aspects of mind, these awakening factors. And to some degree, on a moment-to-moment level, the mind can go either way at any point. So again, with mindfulness, we can observe. Say, no, don't go there, over here. So there's this constant readjusting that we have to do. But I think we want to make sure that we don't do it with vigilance. For me, I had a lot of PTSD in my system for a long period of time. And so I was really, my effort was very too exertion-based, too forcing. I really literally felt like in my younger days on retreats, I was trying to take the present moment and nail it to the floor. Like, just stay. This is what I would do. This is a perfectly good example of wrong effort. Perfectly good example. I would try really, really hard to just be locked into the breath or locked into whatever the object was. And I would get totally smoked and burned out. And I would just give up. And then for 20 minutes, I would let my mind just crawl all over the room. And I just be like, I'm thinking about this, thinking about that. And then I get tired of that, and I'm like, okay. And I would go back to either trying way, way, way too hard or totally giving up. Now, those are both really good examples of not skillful effort. So if you find yourself doing either of those, probably not so good, right? And usually when we want to let the mind off the leash, it's when we've been trying too hard. Like, it's just... So again, how can we find a way, an effort that has a sense of courageousness to it or a sense of endeavor to it? Or really, that's kind of the work. I think it's a good word. We know what it means to work, right? Because I know that a lot of times the way the retreats, you know, you read the description, you look on the website, and you think, oh man, retreat even sounds too nice. I'm going to go on retreat. But no, you're not. You're going to go on retreat, and you're going to sit there, and you're going to deal with your mind moment to moment. It's not going to let you go. Your mind's not going to be like, have a nice retreat, I'll see you next week. We think that's what's going to happen, but that's not what happens. And sort of just, so to get a sense of these, so what we want to do is we want to prevent and overcome the hindrances, clearly. Now, this word prevent used to really jam me up a little bit, because I'd be like, well, how do I prevent something that's not in my mind from arising? Right? And that actually is an interesting area, because I think the only way to do that is actually to live with ethics. So a lot of this training is really an ethical training, right? We're trying to develop these beautiful, wholesome, kind, non-harming qualities of mind, and we're trying to overcome kind of greed and confusion and violence. So a lot of it, we have to realize too, a lot of the cultivation that we're doing is largely ethical, for lack of a better word. Harmlessness, right? And so we don't want to harm ourselves in the process. So that's that, and so part of that is one of the easiest ways to prevent unwholesome or destructive mental states is to live with integrity. You know, to be honest, to be caring, to be kind. And I would imagine anybody who would spend the time to come on a retreat like this has probably already been at this wanting to be a good person game for a while. And I'm in recovery for drug and alcohol abuse, and there's been some times in my life where I was maybe not doing things that were so skillful. But since I've been sober for the last 20 years, one thing I've noticed is there's a lot less destructive forces arising in my mind, because I can't actually tell you the last time I did something that I really feel that bad about. Now, when do these destructive forces, like things like regret and resentment, a lot of times these aspects of mind arise because we've been doing things that we know better than to do. Right? And so it takes a long time to unwind that, but we have to realize that, like, there's such a tremendous aspect of the path that we don't always talk about specifically on retreat, because we're really focusing on the cultivation of the mind. But a lot of it has to do with having a sila, ethics, goodness, right? And when we do things that are, and you probably notice this, when you do things that are in line with your values, what happens is actually these constructive and beautiful forces in the mind arise. We feel gratitude. We feel good about ourselves. So a lot of it is how we live. So again, these things that arise in the mind, they're not just random, but they're not determined either. So we want to just kind of get a sense, because I was like, well, how do I prevent these things from arising? And so a lot of that work you've probably already done and have already probably been doing. And so, like, when we start to look at the ways in which we kind of give ourselves an unfair, hard time, you know, we beat ourselves up. We have some kind of inner critic, inner violence even at times. That's why metta is so great, because what it does is it really, if there's more metta in the experience, then we don't end up having these kinds of thoughts about ourselves. So there's a lot of prevention that can be done and ethics and kind of cultivating these other qualities, kindness, compassion, right? So that's a big area that you've probably in many ways have already been working on, that I certainly recommend that you kind of be aware and you learn to track that. Right? Because I notice if I have a hard day and I get in an argument with my wife, or I'm kind of a little bit short with my kids and kind of just a little bit mean and kind of too quick-tongued, which is easy to do, the next day, these destructive forces arise in my mind. I'm like, man, I really wish I hadn't done that. Or I feel bad. I feel regretful. It's like, okay, there's a connection going on here. So this really is a big, big part of it, I think, that we have to kind of factor in that we don't always do. The second one is, I think, largely much of the work that we do in a retreat context is really trying to overcome these forces in the mind when they're there, so the hindrances being craving, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, and doubt. So I'll kind of talk about those as being overcome and how they work a little bit. sometimes called sense desire, sometimes called craving, sometimes called attachment. But I mentioned this yesterday in the practice. It's that force, that quality in the mind that's wanting, craving, needing. I experience it as just something that I want to be here that's not here now. And if I could get this thing, whatever this thing might be, so we can kind of get hooked into that. And that can sometimes be enjoyable. It can be kind of a healthy distraction. Not a healthy distraction, but an unhealthy distraction. And it's like we can learn to watch that. Okay, like, so we don't want to contribute to that force in the mind. Right? And we have to watch while paying attention to it. Anytime we give something our attention, it's almost the great evidence that you're contributing to its continuation. Right? So if I'm wanting my body to not be in so much pain, I'm wanting to have a little bit more energy, and then I get caught up in wanting that, and then I start imagining how much better it would be right now if I had that, but I don't have that. And so you get in this craving, this wanting, right? And so maybe there's some suffering, maybe not so much, maybe it's a little bit enjoyable, but it's blocking you, right? It's not, it's just going to go round and round. It's not going to go anywhere good. It's unskillful, really. And on the flip side of that, you have the craving and the aversion, which are really big, big ticket items in the mind. I mean, largely that's kind of what the mind is up to. If it's not wanting something, it's not wanting something. You know, I got to get this and I got to get rid of that. And you could fill this and that with thousands of different variables. If I could only have, this is my life, I get the one. If I could only get this, and if I could only get rid of that, I would never ask for anything else again. Right? And that's kind of my general posture towards reality, towards experience, right? So these are, so when you see these in your mind, you shouldn't be bummed. You should be a little bit like, oh, wow, like I'm seeing the hindrances. Like the Buddha's really clear. Like these are the things to liberate yourself from. And there's a little bit, and I'll go through the rest of them too, but just I kind of want to weave these in. I hope you're following along. Is that when we look at the awakening factors, the first one, maybe no surprise, is mindfulness. And so what we can do is we can do this bait and switch where I can turn a hindrance, an obstacle to the path, into actually an object of practice. So I can be caught up in craving, but then mindfulness can come and say, hey, that craving thing has kind of been going on here for a couple minutes. You want to do something about that, or you just want to ride that out? So mindfulness gives us a fighting chance and says, okay, so now what was an obstacle becomes an object, becomes something that Asho says so well. I can either believe in it or I can practice with it. And so when I can take a hindrance, whether it's craving or aversion, if like I'm really not wanting my knees to be hurting right now, and if my knees didn't hurt right now, I'd probably be fully liberated. What it would mean for me to be a person with no pain in my body, the delusional story you come up with that one, how awesome it would be. And then the next day your knees don't hurt and you don't even notice they don't hurt because you have something else to get rid of now. And that will keep you busy all day, right? So then we can start to see mindfulness give us the opportunity to say, okay, like, now what? How can I overcome this? And, you know, how you overcome it is a learning process that we all have to go with. But I think we have to realize when you've gotten to the point of having a hindrance in the mind and a recognition of that hindrance, you did a lot of work to get there, right? So there should be a little bit more celebration. Like, so don't let the hindrances bum you out. There's a great book by Tejaniya called Don't Laugh at the... what's it called if you laugh at the
defilements? Don't look down on the defilements. They will laugh at you.
They will laugh at you. Don't look down at the hindrances. You're not better than the hindrances. You know, it's a healthy relationship. I see you. I respect you. You've had the mic for way too long. We're going to try something else now. Okay. Here's one also trick about the hindrances. You can't use any of the hindrances to overcome any of the other hindrances. Which is very irritating. Because you're like, well, I'll use aversion. We think aversion, I'll just push this thing away and it will go away. Has that ever worked? It's terrible when it works though, because then it really reinforces the delusion. Right? So you can't use any of the hindrances to overcome any of the other hindrances. So you can't, you know, craving and aversion. You can't have aversion towards the craving, because then you have craving and aversion now. And you can actually have all five at the same time, I'm told. Or thus I have seen. The craving and the aversion don't work out, then the restlessness kicks in, then the tiredness and the lethargy kicks in, then the doubt kicks in, and you're like, man, this just can't even be done. No wonder why Buddhism is such an unpopular religion. Nobody can do this shit. This is crazy. Right? So you're just like, and then once the doubt kicks in, it's just like, oh, I wonder if there'll be like some cookies or something for dinner. Those fruit bars were good. And I'll ask Katie if she has any left. Right? And so these are happening quickly, right? And so a little bit, it's almost fun to think about it this way, because I think about it like if there was a game, if there was a Dharma board game, this is the game. It's like, okay, see if you can recognize and overcome these hindrances and develop and maintain these awakening factors, right? And it's also, you know, it's rich within a tradition. This is like really at the bottom of it all, of really what we're trying to do. And so when we start to, so we have craving and aversion are kind of the first two ones that we work with. They're kind of the obvious ones, right? Wanting, not wanting. And then the third hindrance is usually translated as restlessness and worry, sometimes called remorse. I don't know if you've been worrying, if you have anything going on out in the world out there that you're worried about that seems to reemerge in the mind, right? So there's a kind of restlessness, there's a worry, and it's also restlessness of mind and restlessness of the body. It's kind of, in a way, I think it would probably be what we generally call anxiety. So there's a kind of uneasiness, there's maybe a fear. Maybe there's a fear without even an object, which is weird when that happens on retreat. You're afraid, but you're not afraid of or about anything. There's just kind of pure, organic, grass-fed fear. Right? And that makes us uneasy, you know. And we can get really uneasy, we get restless about that. And so the craving and the aversion will lead to restlessness. Restlessness, worry. And so that's so part of it is trying to notice when I'm in that, when the thinking, right, the thinking has, restlessness and worry are good because worry is a pretty easy mental habit to recognize. You know, worry, we all know what worry is, and we know when we're worrying. And so you can kind of be mindful of that, right? You can be aware of that. Say, okay, like, so in which ways am I fueling this? This word clinging, Cheryl will talk about this in days to come. This word upadana, I said one of these words has a double meaning. It means to cling, so that the hindrances have a clinging quality, a gripping quality to them. But also there's a quality of fuel. So a lot of times we provide fuel. You know, the mind is craving, and then there we are just throwing shovelfuls of coal on it, wondering why it's getting worse. So there's a way in which we can assess, well, there's this quality of mind, activity of mind going on, and the first thing I go, well, am I feeding it? And usually what I'm feeding it with is my attention. Right? So we know, like, if I'm caught up in the craving and the aversion, and I can recognize that, and I can pull my attention back and open into sound or to the body or to the breath or whatever it is, it's like I get a little bit of relief from that. So it's kind of counterintuitive, because a lot of times what we have to do to overcome hindrances is we have to like pull something out of them. We have to kind of defund them or defuel them. We have to take, because a lot of times we're pretty invested too. Like I've been invested in solving this problem for a long time. I'm not just going to stop now, because you rang the bell, right? And so that's hard to do that. And a lot of times in the heat of the moment, it's hard to recognize, okay, this is not the direction I want to go. Right? And so we can drop back into that. And then if you look at the other awakening factors, the way that they kind of come out is there's mindfulness. And mindfulness is followed by this word Cheryl's keen on. She'll probably speak more about it, called Dhamma Vachaya, which is interesting, because what does that mean? To investigate the Dharma. It means to investigate or to inquire. I think in many ways, as Kinchin Weber talks about it, it's about having an intelligent relationship with your experience. Right? And so I think one of the first investigations we can do with mindfulness is I think there's some value into learning how to feel the burn of the hindrance. It's like, you know what, it's what the Buddha sometimes calls the honey-tipped arrow. It's like at first it's, and it's immediately, you know, it's that kind of, but we don't usually stay in there long enough to be like, oh, actually, you know what, this is not helping. This is, it's really not good for me to just let my attention race into these different neural structures, into these different habits. It's like, actually, it's unsatisfying. It has never ended well, really. And so there's an ability to just kind of like seeing the dissatisfactoriness of being caught up in the mind. Being like, okay, yes, it's a honey-tipped arrow. Yes, it's a little pleasant. It's a little bit sweet. It's a little more interesting than my breath right now. It has that kind of seductive quality to it. See, a lot of times the hindrances too, the mind is easily, or the chitta the Buddha talked about, is easily seduced. And what we a lot of times get seduced by are these hindrances. So there can be some value in acknowledging the burn of it, or the dissatisfaction of it, or the like, you know, the kind of disappointment. I was like, this isn't going to go anywhere. You know, this isn't going to take me. In fact, not only is it not going to take me anywhere, but what is it blocking me from? Right? It's blocking me from being open, from being spacious, from being more connected to the experience that I'm having. And again, it's tricky too, because a lot of times it can be kind of enjoyable, or it can be kind of pleasant to be caught up in these things. And so there's that kind of way. How do we investigate? How do we inquire? How do we? And that's something you'll learn how to do that. You are learning how to do that. I can't really. It's not one of these things I can sort of describe. And what comes out of that is this word virya, which is very interesting, because it usually gets translated as energy, which I don't think is a great translation, because, again, energy doesn't, it's kind of one of these words that could mean way too many different things. I can put lots of energy into all kinds of fruitless things, and I have. But this word virya, I really like it as courage. It's a lot of times when there's a little bit of mindfulness and a little bit of investigation, we get a little bit of that kind of, maybe we would even use the word intuitiveness of like, oh, this feels right. You've probably had this experience. A lot of times we get it in early Dharma practice where you get into this kind of space of samadhi, of ease, of presence, and it feels oddly familiar. You're like, I know about this. To remember that which has been said and done long ago. Right? It's like, oh, yes. There's a natural intuitiveness of just being just being alive actually is kind of nice and good and enough. Right? And that can give us a lot of sense of like, oh, this is definitely the way. I definitely want to go this way now. Mm-hmm. Right? This is the way to go. And so courage, of course, sometimes carries with it. We think it's this big epic thing. It doesn't always have to be necessarily so epic. But what it does is as you get further out into the awakening factors, you build up a kind of defense mechanism against the hindrances. So when there's investigation and there's a little bit of courage, now when the craving and the restlessness start to kind of cook up out in the periphery, you're like, no. I'm going to stay right here. Right? And so we learn to trust into that. So we're kind of waking up. Right? We're waking up to these things. And so you have mindfulness is the first one. And the first three, which are investigation, energy, and then joy. I'll talk a little bit about that because I think joy, again, is another of these words that gets too highly put on the pedestal. They're considered energizers. That they kind of usually will bring energy, or they'll bring a little bit of vitality, or a little bit of maybe even like enthusiasm into the experience. So we have, you know, when there's mindfulness, the hindrances are kind of abandoned. We get a little bit more interest in what's going on. Well, what is it like to just sit here and actually not have a problem to solve? Pretty cool, actually. I like not having problems to solve, right? A little bit of courage, a little bit of energy, right? And then this word joy, which again, this word piti is one of these words that has probably lots of meaning. Sometimes it means affection. Sometimes it means friendliness, which I saw that earlier today. I was really happy to see that word. And it's kind of an enjoyment. Maybe not so much joy, but something about just being here without having these problems to solve and these tasks to overcome. There's something about the non-doing quality of experience that's actually kind of nice. You know? I've been feeling a lot of it lately because, you know, I haven't been able to teach retreats for the last couple of years, and I have small kids at home, and my domestic life is joyous and full and also kind of very busy and hectic. And so I was just like, when Cheryl wasn't here the first day, I was just like, well, walking around the house, and they're going, man, I gotta find something to do, man. What the hell am I gonna do? And it's just like, I don't have to do anything. I can't remember the last time I didn't have to do anything. Right? And then when we're busy doing stuff, what do we say? Man, I wish I had some time to relax. And then as soon as you get it, the mind's like, yeah, I wish I had something to do. Right? But then it's just again, it turns. You see how it does that on you? It's just like, as soon as it doesn't have the thing, as soon as it has the thing it wanted, it wants something else. Which again, now the hindrances are back, and now you're just back to wanting and not wanting again. So these experiences, they really stand right next to each other in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, so we can recognize them. And now there's probably an emotional sense to these things. There's a psychological sense to them. They're very, very dynamic. The key, though, is being able to just recognize it as a kind of, as an experience that I'm having. Of, okay, as it even says in the Satipatthana, when you have craving in your mind, you know you have craving in your mind. So when it's in my mind, I'm like, I have it in my mind right now. I have aversion in my mind. Right? And so just that awareness of it, is it loosens the mindfulness, what it does that really helps as an awakening factor, is it loosens up the intensity just enough. Right? So if I'm lost in craving, that's one thing. But if I'm lost in craving, then I'm aware that I'm lost in craving. I get a little bit of distance from it. I get a little bit of space from it. Maybe enough of space and enough of distance where I can make a kind of choice to say, actually, let's pull the attention out of it. Let's open the awareness a little bit more and just see what the result is. And the results usually can be really quite immediate. Right? And so, as he says in the first half, the goal of this practice of mindfulness is to monitor the mind's progress. So when you watch yourself do this, which you probably are, you should have a little victory party to some degree of like, oh, well. Because we know I can get caught up in craving for 17, 25, the whole sit. Have you had those? I know you probably don't remember, but have you had kind of a sit where the whole sit was just kind of gone? And all of a sudden they ring the bell, you're like, oh yeah, I didn't even know I was on a meditation retreat until someone rang that darn bell. Right? So part of it is in the mindfulness and the waking up and the kind of being present is not so much what's happening, but what's not happening. It's like, I'm not being obstructed. I'm not being hindered. So there can actually even be some gratitude for, again, the Buddha talks about the presence and absence of. And so we can see when we're in the absence of greed, hatred, and confusion, in the absence of these hindrances, we can maybe have some gratitude or some appreciation. Even though it might be a bit boring. Because a lot of what we cultivate here is an experience that's fairly obvious and to some degree ordinary. It's just you sitting on a cushion in a tent outside. I mean, how great do you think it's going to be? Right? You know, like, what do you really expect is going to happen? Because a lot of times we expect these attainments or this practice to deliver some kind of epic experience, which you may have for a few moments in the entire 7 days. And if you do, it'll be worth it. But it's not the whole time. It's not the whole experience. And so when we start to move from hindrances into awakening factors, now where we've prevented these things, we've overcome these things, and then now this is the cultivation we want to develop and maintain. And another way they talk about maintain is actually to protect. So part of it is when we have these qualities of mind that are conducive, that are skillful, not that we want to continue them. Cheryl talks a lot about continuity of mindfulness. So when the awakening factors are working and we're in that maintenance, we're developed, we're maintaining those, we get moments. Maybe we get 13 seconds. Maybe we get 2 minutes. You'll get these. You get these longer periods of time. There's a theory that they say short moments repeated become continuous. Right, that's kind of a neuroscience way to look at it. So early on in our practice, even the first day, you get these little windows, flashing windows. Oh, there was mindfulness. It's gone now, but I saw the mindfulness. I saw the path. You know, they kind of flicker. And then it's like, then we get these longer periods. We're like, oh, okay. You're a little bit more familiar. That's the Dalai Lama's definition of meditation, is to become familiar. So you want to be familiar with the hindrances. And you want to be familiar with the awakening factors. So again, the hindrances are not bad or wrong, and they're not going to go away forever for good. You will, even the Buddha talks about being visited by the hindrances all the way up until his deathbed. They're not going to stop. Right? So again, we we have to get out of this thinking that being caught in a hindrance is somehow bad or wrong. Sort of par for the course. I mean, if the Buddha and these teachings spent so much time emphasizing these efforts and these hindrances and these awakening factors as being so a quintessential aspect of the practice, it probably means they're going to be happening a lot. You know, it's not like some random occurrence. Craving and aversion are very much built into the experience. And so these other ones, when we get into the latter half of the, so we go from joy into sometimes called tranquility, but I don't think tranquility is a great word because I don't think anybody uses the word anymore. I think what it means is to be contentment. And I think when we start to get, so the first half of these awakening factors, the mindfulness, the investigation, the courage, the energy, the enjoyment, that if that, we want to make sure that doesn't become exuberant, right? We don't want to get too excited. We'll get caught into craving and aversion again. Mm-hmm. The latter half of these hindrances are kind of what they call neutralizers. And so contentment is the first one that kind of, which also hits a lot of other big ticket items. There's a kind of renunciation. There's a metta. There's a not needing anything extra right now. You know, there's a phrase in the Metta Sutra that says, can we be contented and easily satisfied? Can I just be content with being a body sitting in a tent outside in the woods breathing right now? Can that be enough? So, no, I want more. Okay, now you're back to craving again. Or I want less of this and more of that. I want less heat, more shade. I want more shade, I want less heat. So again, it doesn't take very long. So part of it is trying to get into this this contentedness, this not needing anything extra. And I think that takes some work to get there. And then that contentment leads to a kind of sometimes called concentration or samadhi, a collectedness, a unification. Really, in the word I would think of would be is wholesome. Not wholesome as in good, but whole as in complete. Because when we see the whole picture, we see the complete picture. So whole doesn't really mean good, it just means that it's whole. Unwholesome just means that it's not fully completed, we're scattered. So when we get into this kind of samadhi, this concentration, this unification, integration, is that we can see the whole picture, right? We can see that the days and the life and the experience is going to be constantly a combination of pleasure and pain. There's going to be some pleasure, there's going to be some pain, there's going to be some gain, there's going to be some loss, there's going to be some sadness, there's going to be some joy, right? It's just, that's how it is. Right, and so if I can be content and I can be collected in that, then I arrive in the final experience of the awakening factors, which is equanimity, upekkha, which is both of perspective. So it's part of it is right view, is seeing the whole picture, seeing clearly that yes, we are in a living system experience of tragedy and beauty, of sadness and joy, of pleasure and pain. It's saying yes to all of that. And not getting into this like negotiation with reality. We're like, well, give me three of the pleasants and give me, because we sit down to the table of reality and reality doesn't sit at the other side of the table and negotiate with you. So when you show up to the present moment with your list of demands, have at it. I'm rooting for you. I hope it pans out. Right? And so equanimity allows us to see like, okay, there's going to be some sits in the day that are going to be challenging and difficult. There's going to be pain in the body. There's going to be confusion in the mind. There's going to be some times and some fits where I feel connected. I feel integrated. I feel these. So you want to be able to notice, like, are these things present or not? And they're going to change. And so we slowly look over time, of course, the theory is the more that we practice, the less obstructed we are by hindrances, and the more we learn to live into these awakening factors. And even a few percentage points, one tiny little piece of percentage point over time, we slowly turn the trajectory of our life. Right? As the Buddha says, a tree that leans to the east will fall to the east. So a mind that leans towards the awakening factors will eventually wake up. It has to happen that way. If that's where things are trending, as they like to say, are we trending towards the awakening factors or are we trending towards the hindrances? And that's a moment-to-moment skill. Right? And so we get better at it. We get better at it. We get more skilled at it. We recognize it quicker. We see it arise. We get out of it quicker. We have these little victories, and we kind of wake up. And this is kind of the slow, gradual process of waking up. Right? These qualities of mind. And so this is, in the most succinct way, the Buddha is saying this is what he's asking us to try to do, is to try to prevent and overcome these hindrances from corrupting the mind. And again, I think it's more helpful, it's more optimistic for me to look at the path of Dharma, especially in the sequence of the Four Noble Truths. It's not that I'm trying to end suffering so much as I'm trying to create a meaningful life. Right? And so some people say, well, you're saying the same thing by saying that. And I don't think that's saying the same thing at all. I think I'm much more interested in trying to remove the obstacles of the things that are keeping me from going to where I want to go. And I think when we get, of course, Tarsha will talk about the negative attention bias, and one of the things that we like to get negative attention biased on is suffering and dukkha and the things that aren't going well. And a lot of times we contribute to that stuff just simply by paying attention to it. So attention is so important. It's really the primary, what it means in Pali is making in the mind. Whatever I'm paying attention to, that's what's being made. That's what's being manufactured or constructed in the mind right now. So if I'm paying attention to craving and to what I want and to how I'm going to get it, that's all that there is in that moment. There's a kind of feeding. Right? Now, the beautiful thing about attention is as soon as I move my attention, whatever that was over there falls down like a house of cards, and now I have beautiful grass and an open field and a bright sunny day. Right? So like the power of attention, of just moving the attention and being more skillful about where we let the attention get absorbed, is there's so much benefit in that. And you can do that, and you know, you can totally change the trajectory of the mind. You can go from being a full-blown craving machine about this thing over here, and 2 seconds later be totally back and be at ease, and here I am. Right? But part of the practice, and I love the way that he talks about monitoring the mind's progress on the path. Like, to me, that seems like a valuable idea to kind of explore. Okay, how do I monitor my mind's progress on the path? And it's by just watching the moment-to-moment interplay of these experiences, right? And starting to recognize, you know, like I enjoy the world much more than I used to. I don't know that the world's gotten that much more enjoyable in the last 30 years. There's some evidence to suggest it's gotten worse. I don't feel that way. I like people way more than I used to. I don't know that people have gotten any better, right? So it's this basic idea. I think a very encouraging idea is if you change your mind, you change the world. Right? And so if we change the way that we experience, and we incline the mind to being more awake, more interested, more courageous, more content, more collected, more balanced, then that's the kind of world that we'll live in. Because the thing about the early Buddhist tradition is they don't think about the way the world that we do. We think about like the world, that which is really out there, right? That's how we think about the world that which is really out there. But the early Buddhist psychology is saying, no, not at all. Actually, you're making that which is really out there through what are called the five aggregates. So we actually make the world. So if you can get behind that idea, then the best thing to change, the best thing to cultivate is your own mind. Because then you have a much more conducive, wholesome, constructive, kind filter. So you're filtering experience through these kinds of things. So what we're doing here is no small task. Now, whether you think about what you're doing here in terms of what I'm saying, I would encourage you to realize that this is, you know, the Buddha and the early thinkers, they really spent a lot of time on this stuff. This is like, we think we have Buddhism or Dharma now. We have barely scratched the surface to address what's really in this body of work. So it's really, really exciting that we can use these ancient languages and bring them into a context that we live in now and saying, okay, this is like, this doesn't actually, none of what I'm saying actually sounds all that difficult, does it? So it's like if we can really get down into what I would call the algorithm of awakening, it's not that complicated actually. Right? So we just kind of watch, we kind of observe, and we try to practice the first three foundations of mindfulness because they are only in service of our ability to overcome these hindrances and develop these awakening factors. So the more embodied that we are, the more we are aware of how we are being dictated by our feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, the more we are aware of the mind's the churning, the slow churning of the craving and aversion, the greed and the hatred coming online, the more we're just kind of slightly monitoring that, then we have this really radical ability to really say, no, actually, not doing that. You know, we can really make these kinds of choices moment to moment. So again, there's an element to the practice that we hear that is ethical, for lack of a better word. That there's a sense of feeling into that it's actually good to do this. It's good for you. It's good for the other people that you come into. It's harmless. There's something about it that feels, there's a goodness to it, for lack of a better word. And I think that we have to really kind of bear that in mind much of the time. There is a meditative. There is a kind of technical aspect to it. There's a watching of the mind. There's a kind of watching the behavior of the mind, kind of feel like we're kind of babysitting our minds all week, right? And that's a lot of it, is that mindfulness. And so we want to, you know, have as much of it as we can. And then the wisdom that we're looking for comes as a result of those first two. And the wisdom is not just about knowledge. It's about knowing what's skillful and what's unskillful. I'm saying, yeah, I'm not gonna entertain that line of thinking again. I'm gonna be what's called the Jnana Somana Sakara, which is wise attention, as a kind of the outcome. As we know moment to moment, like where can I put my attention right now that's trustworthy? Sometimes they use the word refuge. So it's like wherever, in every single moment, your attention is somewhere. Right? Sometimes it gets pulled to different objects, but we can pull it back. But it's really learning moment to moment on how, where can I let my attention rest or abide, sometimes they say. That is a trustworthy place for it to be. And of course, the past, the future self, other out there problems, worries, concerns, all that stuff, that's not a very trustworthy place to put your attention right now. Not that it's not going to get swept away into that, but there's an enemy we want to protect that. That kind of preciousness of our attention, the preciousness of our... Because if the mind is both resonant and generative, what I'm paying attention to, I'm going to feel. I'm going to feel the effect of that. And I don't want to create, we can create all kinds of bizarre, usual experiences that really are nowhere to be found. How many of you have been caught up in something today that if you looked around, you're like, you have no evidence at all to suggest that it's like we time travel? My son's always like, do you think they'll ever invent time traveling? I'm like, they invented it a long time ago, man. Everybody's time traveling all the time. It's part of the problem. So there will be some more meetings this afternoon at 4:30 with either Cheryl or myself. I hope that this talk and ideas are helpful for you. Keep it up. You're all doing it right. And thank you for your kind attention.